are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Ava Kaufman of avasheart.org. And I also read a story, a personal experience called Goodbye Kidney. And between the two, a couple of gems from Gloria Gaynor. Stay tuned. It is November 17th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Ava Babin Kaufman with avasheart.org. You have a very compelling story and situation, and we want to hear all about it.
Well, first of all, Peter, thank you so much for having me on your show. I love sharing my story because I think the greatest thing that has happened to me since having a heart transplant is I found a new purpose in life. And I think purpose is a really important thing for people to have. And so I feel really blessed that I've been able to fulfill many different purposes throughout my life, and then God chose me to do this one. 15 years ago, I was a successful businesswoman and mother. I had been a professional dancer. I had a black belt in taekwondo. I was strong and fit until I wasn't. So what appeared to be a simple rash was actually a rare autoimmune disease misdiagnosed as psoriasis called dermatomyositis, and it destroys muscles. I went from taking dance class every day in a period of 3 months to needing a walker to walk. I was on my way to get a muscle biopsy and passed out of my house, was rushed to the hospital and put on life support. I have no memory of being rushed to the hospital, of my 11-year-old daughter then, of my family, my friends, nothing. I was placed on life support, and the only thing that would save my life would be a heart transplant, because this disease had destroyed my muscles. It starts out as a rash, but destroys your muscles. So,
an autoimmune disease, like lupus or something.
Yeah,
like
it was dermatomyositis, and it is very rare, and it affects women 40 to 60. And like I said, it started as a rash, and then it destroys your muscles. And I guess because I was in such good physical shape, the muscle weakening came on so fast, and then I was dead, literally dead. So they listed me, I was at Cedars, and they listed me as an experiment because they had never seen that disease destroy a heart before, with never thinking that I would get a heart in time or that I would even live. And, you know, some things in life, I guess, are just meant to be. And in 10 days, on my actual birthday, I received a new heart. I was woken up after the transplant and told that I had just received a heart, and then I was put into an induced coma for 2 months. As I was coming out of the coma, I realized the situation that I was in, which was I was trapped in my own body. I couldn't move, not even a little finger. I couldn't move my head. The only thing I could do was blink my eyes and make a clicking sound. That's all I could do. So I really thought that I was going to die, and I really wanted to die. I was really aware of what my situation was, and I saw the light.
The proverbial light.
I saw okay. The proverbial light, because it's really there. There is an essence. There is a presence of something which I will call God. You can call your higher power or whatever. I'm not a religious person, but I am a spiritual person, and there is something there. And I just wanted to follow the light. I really just wanted to let go and follow the light. I thank God for my incredible life. You know, I had a really big, full, wonderful life, and then I was prepared to leave. And I looked for...
Can I just interject here?
Sure.
Can you talk about that, just because Mystic Pete here, talk about that experience of the light for a second. I mean, okay. We hear about this, but what did it feel like? Was there text? Was there information or just a feeling?
It was more of a feeling, but I could see the light, and I felt like I was lying in God's hands. Like, I didn't feel like I was in a hospital bed. And all of a sudden, I just wanted to go towards this light. It was so compelling. And I looked for my mother and my grandmother and, you know, friends that I'd lost along the way, and there was nobody there, but it didn't matter to me. I just felt so calm and safe, and I felt so trapped in my body that I just wanted to leave. And then, all of a sudden, I smelled my 11-year-old daughter Jade's dirty hair. It smelled like the barn where she rode horses. And then at that moment, we used to fight about her washing her hair. It always stunk. She rode every day after school. She was an amazing little equestrian. And I realized then that I couldn't leave her. My husband and I were in the middle of a divorce, and I just couldn't leave her. So I pulled myself back to the bed from out in this space that I was feeling, and I made a deal with God that if he let me come back to being her mother again, the way I was before, you know, no wheelchair, no crutches, no none of that stuff,
okay.
That I would spend the rest of my life giving back. And that is the beginning of Avis Heart, even though I didn't know that's what it was.
Wow. Okay, so this just catastrophic experience landed in your life. No preparation. You didn't even know what was happening until you're coming out of it. But you made a bargain.
I did. And I fought like hell. It took me 6 months to go from sitting to standing. I had to learn how to do everything again. Walk again, talk again, everything.
Because even if you are coming back by the grace of God, it's still an enormous mountain you have to climb. It's just an enormous chore,
right?
And to rebuild.
I believe if I hadn't been a dancer and I didn't know my body that well, that I wouldn't have been able to come back to how I am today. I mean, I dance, I do a split, I work. I mean, I do everything.
Okay. That you were super healthy, in good shape.
Yeah. And so it was a miracle. And I am so grateful. But I left the hospital in 4 months in a wheelchair, my money embezzled by business partners, newly divorced, and just about broke. And I started Avis Heart without knowing anything about how, you know, the nonprofit world, with my first disability check.
So people were taking advantage of your situation?
Yeah, and my family too.
And you were physically ruined, emotionally probably
and
broken.
The market had crashed, and so my house was sold from under me, and everything
financial. So you were back to zero, or
I was
negative.
Back to zero.
Yeah,
negative.
Got it. Wow.
And
talk about a lot to deal with all at once, and you're in a very compromised state.
Yeah, so like I said, it took me 6 months to go from sitting to standing. And so the first thing that I did was I started volunteering at Cedars. I thought I would start giving back like that. And so I created the first transplant ambassador program at Cedars Sinai, where I would go visit other transplant patients. I did that with my transplant coordinator, Jenna Rush. And I would go visit people waiting for their hearts and, you know, say, walk in and go, hi, you know, I'm Ava, I had a heart transplant, and this is what life is after transplant. And so then I started working in the heart clinic. And when you're getting evaluated for a transplant, whether it's a heart or a liver or lungs, you see a surgeon, you see a you know, a doctor, you see a social worker, you see a psychiatrist, a nutritionist, a financial person, and then they added me to the list, and then I would come in and say, this is life after transplant. And what I learned from doing that was that there were many families who were unable to get on the list because they didn't have a place to stay near their transplant center. One of the things that you need, there's a list of things that, you know, are required, is you need to have a caregiver with you, and you need to be able to be within 30 minutes of your transplant center. Now, that's great, you know, if you live here and not too far away from here, but 35% of all the transplants in the United States are done here in Southern California. We have some of the best transplant centers that have treatments and therapies that aren't offered other places. Many times, a transplant center somewhere else will send you home and say, there's nothing we can do to help you. Maybe try Cedars or UCLA. They do double and triple transplants, and they have antibody treatments. Mm-hmm. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to afford to get yourself there, insurance doesn't cover this, and the hospitals don't provide it.
The housing. Yeah.
It's not covered by insurance.
So it's a very sophisticated operation, very advanced medicine, very expensive. But you have to have a place to live for a while.
Yes, after.
Sometimes
before, depending upon where you're from. You know, I could give you all different stories, but we don't have all day. But
We're in Los Angeles.
Just think about this. The state of Nevada has no transplant centers. So they're either coming here or they're going to Arizona. We get people from New York that, you know, have been told, well, you know, they get hearts faster in California, so, you know, if you're going to wait here in New York, you'll probably die before we get you a heart. So if they're fortunate enough to be able to afford to get themselves out here, and many people do come out here and think they have enough money, and then once they realize how expensive it is here, they realize that they've spent all their money, you know, waiting here to get to, you know, to go into the hospital and get their transplant, and they're broke. So,
like the cheapest place just to rent is $1,500.
Oh, you can't get a place for $1,500.
Oh, okay, no longer.
No,
or
it's
a
like
room and
$3,000.
Okay, $3,000 and living expenses and an attendance. So it's $5,000 a month minimum.
Well, here's an example of something. I received a call from a social worker at UCLA. Wonderful social worker. And have a great relationship with the social workers there. And she called me crying, which she never had done before. I've known her for years and years and years. And she said, Ava, I have this situation. I just got a call from this woman, young woman, Diana's dad, crying that his daughter was going to die because he didn't make enough money to be able to send her to Los Angeles for a year. And so Diana was 28, and she ended up coming here and being here for a year and a month, the longest I've ever had anybody here. She received a heart and a liver, and she had a very complicated case, and she was in and out of the hospital, and she just went home last week.
I think this is when I connected with you.
I saw
this story, and I said,
right.
Wow.
And she just went home last week.
Here, right.
She's 29 now,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, what good is such an incredible surgery, you know, if you can't afford post-transplant housing? I mean, it's just as important. I mean, we help to save her life just as much as the surgeons doing the transplant.
Certainly.
So post-transplant housing is life-saving. There are a few states that, you know, have very wealthy people that have set up, you know, kind of like a Ronald McDonald House for transplants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so needed here in California.
I see.
More than any place else, because we do more transplants than any place else.
Mm-hmm.
Cedars does more heart transplants than mm-hmm. any hospital in the world. UCLA does more combined transplants. You know, they do a lot of lungs and a lot of double transplants. And they do kids. We had a baby here. Right now, at the other house, on Spalding, and we don't own either of these places. So, you know, we pay for them, and we raise money to pay for them and to keep them maintained and going. But what we need is our own place, which in California is just astronomical. And
so you're one of the only people doing this, providing
housing. I'm the only person doing this in California. I mean, in L.A.
Okay.
There is a woman who's doing it up north. Her name is Denise. She has a nonprofit called Heartfelt Help Foundation, and I've reached out to her talking about what I'm trying to do is reach out to other small nonprofits, because I believe that we need a national foundation,
of course,
to deal with the faces of transplant. Because I get requests from all over the country. Sometimes it's just for food and gas cards. Sometimes, you know, they can't make their copays on their medication, which is very expensive if your insurance doesn't cover a certain medication.
Could be $1,000 a week.
Could be.
Yeah, right.
You know, a lot of those really expensive medications you go off of after a couple of months, but, you know, it just depends on your situation. And the reality is that you're on medication for the rest of your life so that your body doesn't reject the organ. I have been extremely fortunate. I have not been sick one day.
Mm.
It'll be 15 years, February 21st. Mm. And I believe it's because I'm making good on the promise that I made to God. I mean, I do really believe that. I feel like if I stop, I'll probably die. So I'll just keep doing it until...
Okay. Keep it.
Just keep it working. Keep it working.
There we go.
And, you know, I've met the most incredible people, you know, in the world of transplant, you know, other transplant recipients, doctors and nurses and social workers and donor families. And, it, you know, it's an incredible community. There's a man whose name is Tom Moen, who was the past CEO of One Legacy, the organ procurement agency here in Los Angeles. And he said to me, you know, the thing about this world is that it's not one that anybody would want to be a part of. I mean, who wants to get a transplant and who wants to lose a loved one and donate their organs? But once you enter this community, you do meet the most incredible people in the world, because the one thing that we all have in common is that we know how precious life is, more precious than what anybody can imagine, and what's really important in life.
Well, I mean, getting a little spiritual here, when you are confronted with death, it puts everything else in perspective. And so much of what life is about on Earth right now is just trivial. It's just silly. It's just people chasing shiny trinkets and prestige or making war. I mean, it's almost trivial and worse. And when death is in front of you, you suddenly see what's important, and all this pettiness is just silly. It's just ridiculous.
It's just unfortunate that a lot of people don't get it, obviously, with what we're living with right
otherwise,
now.
Otherwise, so. Why is there such nonsense happening constantly?
I mean,
priorities are
you know, I really believe that everybody should believe what they want to believe. I also believe that religion is the major cause of every war. So it's like everybody
No argument here.
It's just like everybody should just... I mean, there's one something, whatever it is. Whatever you believe, there's just one thing. There's not, you know, 10 million different gods. Really, there's not. I was there. I saw it. I felt it. There's not. And so if everybody would just leave everybody else alone and believe in what they want to believe in, but I don't know. There are just a lot of really horrible people in the world right now. And, you know, love and kindness doesn't seem to be on the top of a lot of people's list.
Yeah. And on top of that, there's greed. And even bringing it back to this situation, when you have medicine run by profit.
Listen, I mean, who makes I did a TED Talk. It's on my website, avisheart.org, if you want to hear it. And I talk about that. It's like, who is responsible for this? Insurance doesn't cover it. The hospitals don't provide it. There are very, very, very few people who really even know that it exists.
That this issue exists.
That the issue exists. I didn't know anything about transplant until it happened to me. You know, it's not like cancer. Everybody knows someone that had cancer. Everybody knows about chemotherapy and what goes along with that. But nobody, unless you've experienced or know someone who's been through a transplant. I mean, after my transplant, I had people say to me, do you know the person who gave you their heart? I said, well, they're dead. So I haven't met the donor family. And they said, oh, really? They just didn't give you a piece? And oh. I said, no.
Okay.
You know, so I think that now, because of, like, Donate Life Hollywood, that isn't in existence anymore, but One Legacy has taken it over, and it's One Legacy Inspires. But my friend Tanaya Wallace started Donate Life Hollywood, where she really helped work with the TV shows, the medical shows, in dealing with the stories, so that the stories promoted the truth about donation and the truth about transplantation, because for so long in the past, you know, it was just made up stuff, and it made people not, you know, afraid to be a donor. You know, like, well, they're not going to, you know, when the paramedics come to, they're not going to try to save my life if they see I have a dot on my license.
Oh,
and that's so not true.
Ridiculous.
So, I believe,
I never even thought about,
you know,
that.
So, you know, thank you to Grey's Anatomy and Fire Country and The Good Doctor and New Amsterdam for, you know, starting to tell the stories the right way.
Well, I think there's got to be some countries out there, and I don't know which ones particularly, which prioritize well-being and not making money off of medicine, where issues like this are just obviously a part of well-being, and they're taken care of.
Okay, but so we have three great centers here in LA.
Yeah.
We have UCLA, we have Cedars, and we have Keck. Now, you know, USC. USC has really just started their transplant department, and it's really growing. So I can't say anything negative about them, because I haven't even gone in to meet with them, because we only helped two or three of their families because it's new. Cedars-Sinai has not donated a dime to Ava's Heart. Not a dime. And when I went to speak to the CEO about this, when I first started Ava's Heart, he said to me, we are not in the hotel business. The hotel business, I'm not in the hotel business either. I'm in the saving lives business, because you can't get listed if you can't prove that you have housing.
They won't give you the organ unless you can demonstrate you can get housing. Yes.
I mean, when you go to get evaluated, there are so many things that go into it. One of those is that you live within 30 minutes of your transplant center. Now, UCLA has been the only hospital that has supported what I do, with not very much money, but they do support. And I'm sure that every year they've increased it, and I'm sure that this year they will, because I have someone putting together how much money they made by the patients that I've helped. And, and that's who I really feel needs to help support what I do. The people that are making money off of transplant. The pharmaceutical companies give very little. Everybody has, this past year, so many people have stopped donating because of the environment of the world. So raising funds is really difficult.
Well, my point is, this is a part of healthcare.
It is a part of healthcare.
And I'm sure in some countries, it's understood. There's a package that various elements have to be in place for this to be a success. Now, I'm not trying to take the point of view of the hospitals, but like in our situation, like, yeah, it's not our problem to take care of housing, so that's the hospital. But if there was a more healthy healthcare environment, well, then it's obvious this needs to be dealt with.
It's a health inequity. Yeah. So you have to be rich to get a transplant, okay. So you can
afford.
Yeah.
And so now we're talking about a systemic problem. If well-being and health were the priority instead of making money was the priority,
exactly.
It would be an entirely different situation.
Totally different
situation. And you
situation.
Wouldn't have to be spending probably an enormous amount of energy fundraising for what seems like it should be just some obvious need that's taken care of, like, obviously. But you have to exert a tremendous amount of time and all your resources.
And
it's fun. I mean, we're in one of your locations, and it's this beautiful place. I'm sure people heal up here as fast as they can, considering the environment they're in. There's art here. There's plants here. It just feels good. It's sunny. Yes,
it's home.
This is beautiful. It's clean.
What happens is it's
and it doesn't smell like bleach or it's
no.
Just, it feels good here.
It is.
This is one of your places.
Yes. And the other place is just as nice.
I love it.
At the other place right now, we have a little girl. Her name is Olivia, and she's 4. And she had a heart transplant, and she was very sick for a long time. And before she had her transplant, she had a stroke. So she has this little hand that doesn't really move that well, and she's just like learning to talk and walk now. So she's there with, you know, another family, this man named Ricky, who, so she's found a way to communicate with him, and there's a backyard there because it's not in an apartment, it's a house, and she, like, pats her chest and goes up to him, and that means she wants him to take her outside. It's really sweet. So the relationships that people build here, many become longtime friends forever. At one point, we had 3 families here from Las Vegas. They didn't know each other, and now they're all best friends, and they're back home.
Yeah, so that's something else that's happening. There may be several people in recovery living together. So there's actually, you're not isolated.
You're not isolated.
Which is also very important.
But you're not in a hotel alone.
Right, right.
You know, you have your own space. You have your own bedroom and your own bathroom. And, you know, as you saw, they're beautiful and clean and, you know, linen and towels. Everything's provided, and the kitchen is beautiful with everything. And so people do cook together, and they do eat together. Not all the time, you know.
When they choose. But feeling isolated is just deadly.
Yeah, and because people are here from far away, so it's not like they have friends here or they have family here. It's just them and their caretaker. So it becomes very quickly a family here. Well, and it happens all the time, no matter who the people are, no matter what age they are, this amazing thing just happens all the time. And I always wonder, like, when a new family comes, how's it gonna work? And it always works. You know, and the people that have been here longer make it easier for the people who just come. And it's a beautiful thing to watch because the world isn't like that. You know, and it's light and bright and cheery and, you know.
It feels nice
here. You
can see
trees as a terrace. And
yeah, well, your vision for housing has a lot of heart to it.
Thank you.
Avasheart.org is, you know, where people can donate and support your work. And until there's a systemic change where healthcare becomes, you know, all these components are just taken care of by a system, and then you're put out of business.
That's okay.
And then you're free to become a professional dancer again.
No, that's not happening again. Listen, I was a professional dancer in the 70s and 80s. I was a backup dancer for Gloria Gaynor in 1976.
Okay, yes, we shall survive.
I shall survive. My theme song.
So, let's just talk a little about this other issue which we discussed, and that's just donors. Well, sometimes they're a family member and they go on living if they're donating a kidney.
Right. You can be a living donor and donate a kidney or a piece of your liver.
Yes.
But in order to donate your heart or your pancreas or your lungs, I mean heart and lungs, you need to be dead.
Right. And there's a whole nother issue, and now we're getting into it. Nobody has even thought about this, but you have to do something with the remains.
Yeah, so the Organ Procurement Agency, and ours is One Legacy, as I said, and I've been a community partner with them for a long time. You know, they do, they're amazing. I mean, you know, they treat the families with such respect and explain to them the process of things, and things have come a long way. You know, they have an honor walk in the hospital when someone's a donor, and they, you know, all the doctors and nurses applaud as they wheel the body.
Isn't
to
that something?
And One Legacy's facility is beautiful, where they procure the organs, and the person can be on life support for a few days so the family can come and say their goodbyes. I mean, it's really done in the best possible way, with the most love and the most kindness, truly. But then, you know, the body's yours to bury or cremate or do whatever you're going to do. And so there are many families, especially in Los Angeles, you know, our low-income communities, that don't, you know, haven't saved, or there's no life insurance policy, and so they need help. And so for me, in order to complete the circle of life, I felt that a donor saved my life and that I wanted to give back to the donor families. We don't have a lot of money, and so we just give small grants to any family. We give a small grant towards cremation or whatever they want to do, if they want to go have a big funeral, whatever. But most people cremate. That's up to them.
That's nice.
Just write a check. I talk to them, you know, console them, tell them that a donor saved my life, and you know, that their loved one is leaving an incredible legacy. And the thing about being an organ donor is you never know who's going to get that organ and what that person is going to do with their life. And this is what I've chosen to do with mine, because someone gave me the gift of life. So, you know, I console them and we talk, and, you know, One Legacy has a great grief counseling and things, but just that little check makes such a really big difference. Just the fact that somebody cares enough to do it. And so I'm hoping to grow that program. I mean, there's so many families, many who's mostly, I think the most difficult of those situations are when I speak to a mother or a father who've lost their child. And whether they're in a car crash or hit by a car, or they drown, or they die of a fentanyl overdose, which there are so many that it's scary. I mean, so many good kids that go to a party and think they're taking something, and
just having fun, not an addict or any of these other heavy-duty terms.
Right. And so when I talk to those parents, you know, who, I mean, the devastation is just beyond. I can't even imagine it. And I feel that I'm able to make them feel better about the choice that they've made, or their loved one has made, in being an organ donor, because you do pass on a legacy. Now, my donor family has chosen not to meet me, but I wake up every day and I thank my donor family, and I've given her or him, but I think it was a her, a name called Strength. And so Strength and I are, you know, committed to this cause, and together we move on and hope to make some great changes. And I'm hoping that I'll soon have enough money to have people assist me with what I'm doing, so I can really get out there and speak about finding your purpose, and about organ donation and transplantation, and how truly fortunate we all are to have life.
And I'm guessing that some of what you're talking about is in your book called Shark Heart, which I'm guessing people can find on your website, avisheart.org.
No, they can find it on Amazon.
Okay. Shark Heart.
Shark Heart by KB Hill and Ava Kaufman. My best friend, Tina, who came to visit me every day in the hospital, for 4 months while I was sick, is a beautiful writer, and I had asked her during COVID if she would help me write a book. She really wrote it. And it's my story weaved into other transplant stories and other donor family stories and medical miracle workers, and just it's a just true stories of sacrifice and love told by the fighters and survivors and the souls that live on through the legacy of organ donation and transplantation.
But what they can find on Ava's Heart is your TED Talk, which is...
They can find my TED Talk, and they can find a beautiful piece that Laura Diaz did on the house called Ava's House of Miracles, and they can donate to help us continue this work that we're doing. We have a campaign called It's Just One, so anybody can just donate $1 a month. I mean, everyone in the world can afford $12.
Cents, whatever, yeah, just,
so if a million people would just donate $1 a month, we'd be doing really great.
This problem would be solved.
Problem solved.
And just to kind of wrap things up, I think you'd mentioned that the alternative, you knew of people who were living in their cars right after a heart transplant.
Yeah, well, the thing is, there are many caregivers that live in their cars, and the patients' families live in their cars. And here's an example. I had a woman who had applied for housing. She had a double lung transplant, but she was in the hospital for very long after. And so finally, her social worker reached out to me and said, you know, do you think that, you know, Bobby Ruiz will be coming out of the hospital soon, but her husband's been sleeping in his car in the parking garage for 6 months. They live in Bakersfield.
Can you imagine? What a...
And he would go visit her every day, then he would, once a week, drive up to Bakersfield to shower and change his clothes. Jeez. And see his daughter, and then come back. And he came here. He was one of the first families that came here. And when he came in here and went to the room, he just said, wow, a bed and an air conditioner. What a concept. Oof. And I was a CNN hero. I didn't win. I didn't even make the top 10, but I was a CNN hero. And you can see that piece on the website too. And Ray's there, and you see his reaction when he walks in the door. It's pretty amazing.
Well, we've discussed that there needs to be systemic change to really solve this problem in the medical field. We've discussed issues about death and dying, and that's another field that needs to be addressed. Of course, also addiction and recovery. We've gone through three big ones, but right now there's a way to contribute to the situation we have at hand. And Ava, I'm so happy to talk to you and support your work.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you for letting me share my story. And
avisheart.org.
Avisheart.org. Thank you so much.
You're the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye.
Goodbye Kidney by Mystic Pete. I teach mysticism. I teach people to see auras, to astral travel, and to do energy healing, particularly how to heal the self. I'll get to some of the other woo-woo topics in future essays, but this one is about healing. About 3 years ago, Kim, one of my mysticism students, was considering donating a kidney to her dad. With complete kidney failure, Dad had to go to dialysis a couple times a week, and he was miserable. At first, Kim didn't want to. But slowly, she came around to deciding to donate her kidney to her father. It may have been her feelings of dutiful familial obligation kicking in, which she told me was particularly strong for Koreans, or her just wanting to do a good thing for her appa. I'm guessing probably both. Kim asked me for a healing session to help her come to peace about the upcoming surgery. She needed some help sorting through the tsunami of forces rattling her. In our healing session, we sat facing each other at my kitchen table over mugs of steaming, freshly brewed oolong tea. I found holding a cup of warm tea very soothing to my clients and helped them to relax and open up. For the first part of the session, we talked through each of Kim's worries that I'll explain shortly. I didn't advise. I simply listened. I validated each one of her sharp and unsettled emotions, letting her give the many complex feelings storming around inside their moment to be observed and experienced and thereby settle. Most were in the realm of fear or outrage, but there was also some sadness as she came to recognize the loss of how her given family failed at being the family she wished she'd had. She told me that everyone else she confided to about the imminent harrowing experience gave her advice, told her not to worry, dismissed the seriousness of the situation, or simply changed the subject. As I said, I just listened. And one by one, I could see each of the worries drop from her shoulders, unburdening her from weight, loosening the vise of mental oppression, makes everything easier to deal with, whether related to health or any other challenge of life. We discussed the following. 1. Dad issues. Perhaps the gift of a kidney was a way Kim could resolve her fraught relationship with him. One would hope it wouldn't make things more complicated. They were never very close. He had fought in the Korean War and embodied a model of manhood from an earlier era. Stoic, don't show feelings, harsh discipline. A soldier, a man of few words, and the words that were spoken rarely encouraging. He provided for and protected the family. Never weak, hard. 2. Then there was the really hot issue. Dad, and the family overall, was uncomfortable about her being a lesbian. This sexual matter was dealt with by not dealing with it, as were most sexual matters. The fact that she was gay wasn't talked about in the family, who hoped it would just go away. But it didn't go away. After years, she was still a lesbian. Not that it was a secret, however, Kim chose to be quiet about her sexual orientation, knowing how difficult this topic was for a traditional Korean family, who came from a country for which the entire topic of homosexuality and sexuality itself was difficult. 3. Within a family that loved each other, at least at the basic level of devotion to bloodline, other dysfunctions were present relative to authority, jealousy, and communication, or rather the lack of, and even violence. 4. Supporting herself through the recovery period after the surgery. She was living month to month, or rather day to day, besides not knowing how she was going to pay the rent and sustain herself while healing. Long-term employment opportunities would be lost. 5. Wealthy brothers wouldn't be contributing their fair share to see her financially through the time she was disabled and healing. She didn't like one of them much, and she liked the other one just a little. To be blunt, she wasn't all that fond of her father either. And further, the boys didn't really acknowledge or appreciate the sacrifice Kim was about to make with her very own flesh on Dad's behalf. 6. Wives of the wealthy brothers made things worse because they didn't want their well-to-do families to shoulder the burden of helping their husbands, dads, financially struggling weirdo daughter, Kim, while she healed up. And Kim's brothers didn't stand up to their wives' stinginess towards their mutual father or stick up for Kim. Listeners, are you still with me? 7. The pain and anguish of the surgery itself. 8. Losing a very significant portion of her body. 9. Body image. There would be scars, although with advanced techniques, they're not that bad these days. Of course, maybe she'd slim down a bit by losing a few pounds of kidney fat. That's a joke Kim told me. While we think that being somber in their presence is considerate, those facing tragedy or even death often welcome the balm of humor. 10. What if the transplant fails? Dad's body may reject the new kidney. How awful would it be to go through so much misery and expense for nothing? 11. What about the relative risks? Him going to dialysis for the last few years of his life versus her going through hell so he wouldn't have to. 12. And finally, general life and death issues. Because of inherent risks, for instance, from reaction to the general anesthesia they'd both be under, sepsis afterwards, and so forth, Dad could die from the operation. She could also find herself dead. How many people facing hardship, medical, financial, relationship, career, have someone to talk to who just listens? Kim was able to sort through her complex emotions simply by me holding space. I didn't recommend rubbing CBD oil on her lats, kneeling at the feet of my guru, sleeping with crystals, changing to a rigorous keto diet, getting her astrological chart done, consuming ivermectin, eating industrial bleach, injecting the opioid peptide called Combo into her arm to induce vomiting, such substance obtained by milking the skin of secretions produced by tortured South American giant leaf frogs, or drinking urine procured from a child, which is then fermented. The urine, not the child. If you're familiar with the wellness community, you'll know I'm not making this stuff up. I gave no advice. I merely gave empathy. After the emotional channel was somewhat cleared, it was time for the hands-on work of laying on of hands. I drew chi through her organs and various acupuncture meridians, getting the healing energy flowing and strong. In other words, performing a silly, superstitious religious rite in the eyes of people who don't believe such subtle forces as chi even exists. And then I whispered directly to her kidney to reassure it. Okay, I'm a mystic from California. Explaining to the flesh, you are about to get cut, but you will heal and restore, and then you'll be helping Dad live. A side issue, but one I had to deal with as a healer. I had to quell my own ambivalence because I wasn't sure donating a kidney to a 78-year-old man with whom I had a conflicted relationship was a good idea. In a similar situation, I don't think I would have done it. But this was Kim's decision, and I supported her in making her own choices. For whatever her reasons, this surely was a courageous choice that took strength of character. Well, they both survived the operation beautifully, and after recovery, the donated kidney functioned well inside of its new host. Kim's sisters-in-law got over themselves, and her brothers ended up being generous. In a lot of ways, this crisis brought the family together. Did my contribution help a bit? I'm sure it did. Kim moved away about a year ago, and we had pretty much lost touch. But I just saw on her IG post that her father had recently died. She posted a picture of herself forlornly looking out the window of a plane flying high above the clouds on the way to her dad's funeral. Was Kim's whole ordeal worth a couple years of a better life for her appa? Did she make the right choice? No easy answers in this true tale. Like a lot of life and death decisions, all we can do is first vent out our reasons for and against and clear our conscience, and then decide with our hearts. And as for the rest of us, to help make their choice easier, we show up with care and kindness. We show up with our hearts. We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the wonderful Ava Kaufman of avasheart.org, and I read a story that I wrote called Goodbye Kidney. And between the two, a couple of gems from Gloria Gaynor. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mr. Pete out.